Hi, welcome to Breast Cancer Briefing, the podcast where we are breaking down the latest research and science in breast cancer, one conversation at a time. I am your host, Sarah Nunnery. I am a breast medical oncologist and the director of breast cancer research at Tennessee Oncology based in Nashville, Tennessee. And we have a really special episode today. I'm really excited about the very special guest who is with me. She is a comedian, a content creator. She is a self-proclaimed, but I can vouch that it's true, metastatic baddie. She's a 10-year metastatic breast cancer survivor, and I'm really excited that she's here to share her story and her perspectives with us. So a warm welcome for Miss Annie Bond.
Hello.
Hi, Annie. So glad you're here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yay.
And what an intro. I will gladly claim the title of Metastatic Baddie.
Thank you. I thought you would appreciate that. It couldn't be more true.
I love saying it, so it works out.
Yes. So I love, just for some context, Annie and I just met earlier today working on some projects together.
And now we're best friends.
Now we're best friends. Her energy is so infectious. And can't stop laughing when you're around her. So we'll see if we can get through this episode without keeping a straight face. Get some good info. But no, really, like your outlook and your story, it's amazing. So I can't wait for people to hear it and get to ask you a little more about it. It's so amazing how open you are and sharing everything you've been through. And I think we need a lot more of that for our patients. So
thank you. And thank you for being a doctor, because we also need more doctors.
Thank you. It's an honor. So just to start things off, of course, the question you've been asked a million times, but kick us off with your diagnosis. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, you were so young. Tell us about how, you know, what symptoms you first had and how your diagnosis was made.
Yeah. So in 2014, technically, I was 25, living in LA, doing stand-up comedy, trying to be a sitcom star. And my boyfriend at the time felt a lump in my breast, and I hadn't been doing self-exams or anything like that because I don't have a family history. Like, why would I worry? I'd gotten, you know, my yearly checkup. So, like, you have dense breasts. Like, who cares? It's so normal. And I went to my regular gynecologist, and basically they were like, don't even worry about it. Like, no big deal. But I felt like it was getting bigger and that it wasn't really going away. And then I felt like I was like gaining weight in my left armpit, which now I know is probably like swelling from my lymph nodes. But other than that, like I felt completely fine. But I went to another doctor to get it looked at. I turned 26, got my own insurance for the first time, and then went to my own new doctor. And they basically said the same thing, but they did recommend me to get an ultrasound. Unfortunately, that was subsequently denied by my insurance. And I did not think to even appeal it because, again, they kept saying, like, this is just overkill. Like, you're fine. You're so young. You're so healthy. Like, humble brag. Like,
great,
you know? And then I thankfully had the intuition or whatever you want to call it to keep getting it looked at. Like, went back to another doctor just to be like, you know what? I don't think I really liked that doctor. Like, let's just go check with somebody else. And she really pushed for me to get the ultrasounds, like to like work to make sure that all of that would happen. And thank God she did, because right after that, after 9 months of actively trying to be diagnosed with breast cancer, I was. Right. You know, I kept thinking, like, what do I know about medicine? Like, I have an acting degree. Like, I have had like normal medical things happen. But I just didn't know to question that, or that I even should be inclined to question that. Like, my sister had a benign lump removed. I just thought, you know, people get lumps. It's no big deal. But I wish I would have thought, like, oh, and people also get breast cancer. Because even when I got the diagnosis, like, I was working a double at the restaurant I was working at, and, like, went on a break to go get this, like, results. Who cares? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I quickly went into a whirlwind of staging, getting everything scanned, checking out. I had lesions in my pelvic bone and in my liver, and they did the bone biopsy first. That came back negative. So we were like, okay, the liver is probably a hematoma or something. I have little bony islands, which are little birthmarks.
Yes.
Never heard of those
common,
either.
Very common.
Would have never even known they existed.
Right.
And then the liver one did come back positive. So I was diagnosed de novo at 26 years old with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. I was ER/PR positive, HER2 negative, and I had a luminal A subtype, which it did take until my third opinion for anyone to even tell me that or mention what that meant or anything like that. So that's my diagnosis story, yeah. Essentially.
No, and there's a couple of things that I'm so glad you alluded to that are worth saying. We were talking about this earlier. We, for the longest time, and even when I was in medical school, I remember you're taught, you know, in young women, cysts, lumps, they're normal. They're fibrocystic changes. They fluctuate with the menstrual cycle, which is true. But it's not, you know, it is no secret now that we are seeing an increasing incidence in breast cancer in younger women. And I think it's, you know, it's just so important to see women like you who are more visible about sharing your story, especially on social media and just getting the word out there that you really do need to advocate for yourself if there's any change in the breast. It doesn't have to be a lump. You know, it's kind of the most common thing, but breast cancer can present in many different ways. It could be just a change in the shape of the breast, change of the skin or texture, you know, anything that's new and different for you. Like, you really do need to advocate and make sure someone is referring you for imaging. I also wanted to ask you about your first oncology visit.
Yes.
We were talking earlier. I heard a little bit about it, but will you mind sharing a little bit more about what that first oncology appointment was like? I know you ended up going to multiple different oncologists, and I would love to hear more about that and what led to that.
Yeah, so I literally, the first oncologist I met with, I saw right after I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, an hour after. Like, she diagnosed me and was like, there's an oncologist down the street. Do you feel okay to drive? Which was crazy that I said yes, honestly, because I couldn't, like, see or hear straight. Like, I was having, like, the Charlie Brown teacher kind of moment. And I was just in such a state of shock that I feel like I, like, teleported down there somehow. It wasn't even a very far drive. But I remember being in the car and being like, I'm obviously completely
this
sober.
Should not
be in the car. I was like, oh, no. And I was very quickly, like, just told a lot of a lot. Mm-hmm. And in a way that it felt like I was just being told I was going to die. He was like, you have 2 to 5 years, 5 if you're lucky, which, like, you probably won't be. Like, it just kind of felt like that. And I was in such a state of shock that I couldn't really digest anything. And, you know, I just told my parents, I just told my boyfriend, like, it was just a lot. And then my mom came out to help me, and we both kind of felt like, you know, this must be the standard of care. This must be how it is. You must, like, we'd wait 3 hours for every appointment, which was insane for, like, a private, you know, we'd just be sitting in the waiting room and just for hours. They were out of our network. Like, there was just so many things that I felt like weren't communicated well, the worst of which being my fertility rights, which were not told to me by that doctor. And it was a nurse that had brought it up at one of my many scans that I had and biopsies, just asked, you know, has anyone talked to you about your fertility? Because you're young, and if you get chemo, it's going to kill about 50% of your eggs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's crazy that no one's brought that up to me. So I went and saw a fertility doctor, and then I went back to my oncologist and just had asked him about, you know, these options about, like, freezing my eggs or whatever. And he was so upset with me. And it was shocking to me that he was like, why would you even consider doing that? Like, you have stage 4 cancer. It's too dangerous. And I'm like, well, I just think I deserve to have options. And I didn't have the language to say any of that. I was just, like, kind of shocked by how upset he seemed. And then he told me he would fire me as a patient, like, exact words, if I froze my eggs. And I did anyway, you know. And the timeline of that was crazy, too, because it was, like, a Friday when I had the fertility appointment to do whatever testing for where you are in your cycle. And she was like, well, basically, you have to start on Monday, and it's going to be out of pocket because insurance won't cover it. So I hope you've got, like, $13,000 laying around, because good luck contacting one of these wonderful nonprofits that fund that stuff on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Right.
But it was because of that, that it was almost a good thing in a way that I had a bad experience at that office, because it kind of catapulted me into advocating for myself, because I went to get a second opinion. And it feels, when you're diagnosed with cancer, like you have no time. Like, everything has to happen right now, or you're going to, like, implode and die or something.
Right.
Like, it just feels like you have no time. Everything has to start right now, right now, right now. And the biggest thing I always tell people now is you have time to get another opinion. You're not going to upset your doctor. If it does upset your doctor, it's probably not the right doctor, because cancer is not a one and done. Like, it's not like, you know, I had an issue with my tonsils, got my tonsils taken out eventually. Like, they know that's, you're done. You don't have to go to tonsil care for the rest of your life or anything. Mm-hmm. Cancer is an art in a way, because it is so complex and it is so individual. And so I went and got a second opinion. Felt like she was kind of telling me a similar plan of like, we're going to treat you kind of more like your stage two because you only have the one area of metastasis in your liver. And I didn't really understand any of that. And so I went and got a third opinion just to be sure, you know, third time's a charm. Right. And there, like, they sat me down and they, like, recorded everything. And I felt like I just had time. And I felt so comfortable to ask the questions. And he explained my disease to me in a way that no one else had been able to. And it doesn't mean that they were not good doctors.
Right.
But bedside manner matters. And the way that you communicate to patients matters because we need to understand. And I didn't understand anything until that third appointment. I really didn't. And, like, yes, I have a theater degree, whatever, but at the end of the day, I was being told it's your choice what your treatment is. And how can I make a life or death decision when I don't have the education? Right. And my mom is not a doctor. She's a writer. Like, mm-hmm. we want to do what the doctor tells us because that's what we've always done. Mm-hmm. And so it was such a relief to get into that space and to feel like I finally understood not only what my disease was, but why it was going to be treated the way it was. Because everyone else wanted to do chemo, radiation, like jump right mm-hmm. into it. He was the only one that said, you know, there's some these new treatments, these CDK4/6 inhibitors that I think would be really beneficial for you that we just might as well try before we do chemo because of your luminal A subtype. You have a slow growing cancer. Chemo works best for fast growing cancers. Like they can outsmart each other. And in that situation, it's just more likely to happen. He gave me a funny analogy about like a lady is standing and there's like a kid and then there's like a robber. And if you like hold out if the robber's running, she could just stick her foot out and then you trip him. And yeah. like, but if they're both walking, it's a different fight. So like the speed of things matters. Wow. So like the yeah. benefit I would get out of fast acting chemo right. would be, I would just be in menopause and that would be yes. like the best benefit I would get out yeah. of it. And there's much less painful ways to put people into menopause, even though menopause sucks. Yeah.
Yes, we're going to come back to that. But I couldn't agree with you more on so much that you just said. I think it's so important for patients to feel comfortable with their doctor and feeling like they're able to ask questions, feeling comfortable talking about symptoms, because as we'll get to with menopause, there's a lot of uncomfortable things to talk about.
You don't say.
Yes, and you need to be able to voice those. And no one should feel ashamed of getting a second opinion, finding someone that you feel comfortable communicating with. I hope most of us, I can say, you know, most of us, we aren't offended if you want a second opinion.
Don't be a jerk, but like right, you can hurt yes. your doctor's ego a little bit and they'll be fine.
Yes, they're going to be fine. You know, personalities are different. You know, not everybody's going to click. And
yes.
that's okay. And I promise you, if someone doesn't click with me, I would rather you have a doctor that you feel really comfortable with. I think people should definitely advocate to get another opinion if you're not feeling like everything makes sense.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad you've been open about talking about that experience. So you went through, you froze your eggs.
Yes.
Which is amazing. And I definitely think that's a big area where we could do better and improve the fertility care.
It's getting better. There are more yeah. insurances covering it and stuff now too, but it is such a timing thing
right.
that it's like there's a lot that needs to be done there because it is
absolutely
crazy.
Absolutely. and I'm glad that there's more attention going towards that now. Then after you froze your eggs, you get started on your CDK4/6 inhibitor.
Yes.
And then did you do like Lupron or an injection combined
yes.
with endocrine therapy?
What's crazy about Lupron, because yes. I did go on Lupron,
yes.
Is my body was stronger than Lupron. My little 26-year-old
yeah.
ovaries were like, nope, we're doing it anyway.
Yes.
I kept having breakthrough periods.
Okay.
And I not only, and I have had a lot of friends who I've been on Lupron for a long time, great experience, no side effects. I couldn't eat. Mm-hmm. I was nauseous all the time. And then like 1 week of the month, I would be ravenous in the way that like I couldn't feel full. So I was either starving or I couldn't feel full. And like both are terrible, actually. Like the other side is bad too, when you're like, I'm
yeah.
eating and I'm not feeling full. And I was just losing so much weight and I was so stressed out and I was like struggling with thinking food was safe anyway because I was like, it must be my fault I have cancer, all of that. And Lupron for me was tough. I just had a really, and I knew it was the Lupron because it was lining up with the shot every time. And I kept having breakthrough periods. And I was like, I don't think this is working. And so I wanted to get my ovaries out. Like I'd been, they talked to me about it, but nobody wanted to do it because it's irreversible. And I was so young and they're like, but what if, and I was like, I don't care anymore. Like my quality of life is what's at stake here. And they really were like, yeah, okay. It is your decision if you want to do it. And that's fine for you. Cause I think especially with young women, like they want us to think about our fertility and this and that. So we have options in the future, but it does become a matter of life or death. And when I'm looking at, am I going to be alive? Like, for me personally, I know this is not true for everyone because some people have always dreamed of being a mother. That wasn't my main concern. I just wanted to be alive. I was like, if it happens, it happens. I had never felt like this is something I have to do in my life. Like I got a dog and when I was getting radiation and that was a great choice. And I know dogs and human children are different, okay? But that's my baby, my lemon baby. But yeah, so eventually I did get my ovaries out after a couple years on Lupron and it greatly increased my quality of life and actually my menopause side effects lessened. They changed, like my hot flashes stayed pretty much the same, but I don't really get night sweats anymore. Like there were just some things that changed with that. But yeah, Lupron is great, but it did not work for me, which sucks because it is great. And it was not, my body did not like it.
It's, and you're not the only one. Absolutely not. Yeah, see, definitely can see that. The menopause symptoms. I feel like as a physician, that's one of the hardest things to prepare people for or even talk about the side effects. If you, you know, we could write a book on all the potential side effects from menopause. And it's such a spectrum to how everybody feels on these drugs. You know, we've got some patients who really have minimal side effects, some who are really debilitated. And it's one of those things I always tell patients, like, it's really hard to know until we just get into it, how you're going to feel. And we'll troubleshoot along the way. How soon after starting your treatment did you start to feel differences in your body? And do you remember what the initial like major ones where you were like, oh,
yeah,
this is it? Yeah.
Oh, it was immediate because of the freezing of the eggs. So going from putting estrogen, like extra estrogen into my body to then taking it all out was crazy. And I mean, mentally is where I felt it first, not even physically. I felt like I was losing my mind. And given there was a lot of adrenaline and stuff going through me every day from the cancer and all of that, like just from the experience of everything. But the emotional swings that I was taking was wild. Like I cried in a Sears over a mattress delivery date because I was like, where are we supposed to sleep? And it's like, in the bed we have? I was like, oh, right. What's going, why am I so upset? I was like, I can't stop. I'm still upset. And I, it's completely illogical. Or I would wake up in the night with like intense sweats, or I kept feeling like I'd be walking and then it would feel like the driest breeze ever had just gone like straight up into my vagina. And I was like, oh, that's odd, you know? And then you notice like, you know, sex becomes kind of painful and there's just all of these things that start to happen that you don't even realize. And also when you're young and getting diagnosed with a cancer that you feel like you're going to die of in a few years, you're not listening as much to the long-term side effects of things. So those have been really fun to learn too, because I was like, well, if I get there, it's a privilege, you know, like if I make it that long, it's a privilege to deal with the side effect, right? Which honestly is not the right perspective to have. Like, no, it can suck and it can still be a privilege to be alive. Like both can exist.
Yes, but
I feel like my doctor did a really good job trying to prepare me for menopause and I still felt completely unprepared.
Yeah.
Because it is just a wild, weird thing. And my mom was going through natural menopause at the same time. But even then, it's like, you know, I would talk to older women who would be like, oh, well, once you get the pills, you'll feel great. And I'm like, the estrogen pills?
Yeah.
I can't take those.
Right.
So, and then they don't understand that we stay in menopause for so long.
Right.
Like, that's the other thing. People go through menopause. We go into it. We don't go through. We go in and we get stuck in there.
And we take it to a different level with these medications as well. Yeah. You've been very open about the mental aspects of it and mental health. You were talking earlier this morning when we were chatting just about feeling guilty about some of the thoughts you have, like that there's this perspective that, A, you know, you're a warrior. You can't have a soft side, and B, you should be so grateful for being here. What did it take to really start to address your mental health and feel more comfortable talking about your mental health? And then anything too that has helped the most with mental health for anyone who might be listening and feeling those struggles?
Yeah, I think we put an extraordinary expectation onto cancer patients that is completely unfounded and unfair, because you should not feel the pressure to be a warrior when you're going through cancer treatment, because nothing will make you feel weaker. Like, we'll show you your weaknesses, we'll show you your vulnerabilities, we'll make you scared to your core than thinking, I'm going to die. And for me, like, I'm a middle child, I'm a comedian, I love to make people happy. To have to keep thinking to myself, like, crap, now my siblings are going to have a dead sibling, and my parents are going to have lost a child. Like, so you have to deal with those thoughts at 26.
I can't imagine.
It's absurd.
Right.
And then you can't talk to your friends about it because they don't understand.
Right.
They don't know how to talk to you about that. Even like with the best intentions, they just don't know at that age. And I don't think at any age you even know. Like, even, you know, I meet women who have been diagnosed in their 30s and 40s, and it's like the same thing. We just don't know how to approach that. And for the survivor yourself, you feel an obligation. You feel like, okay, I'm going to do everything they tell me. And in treatment, like, you feel like you have such a sense of purpose. Like, I listen to the doctor, I go to the doctor, and I'm doing the treatment, and everyone's telling me I'm so strong, people are running marathons for me, and like, this is wonderful, like, it's all wonderful. Why do I feel so crappy inside? Why do I feel so shitty? And it's that guilt and that shame is overwhelming, and you feel like you're not allowed to express it, because then you're not a warrior. Then you're not grateful. Then, you know, if you, to somebody who tells you the story about someone they know who died some horrible death from cancer, well, you're still here.
Right.
So you better be grateful. And you can't live in that. And it is miserable. And I remember when I lost my first friend, it was my first friend I'd made. Like, she just also went to a similar hospital. She played music. We just became friends really quick. And she was early stage when we met. And I was like, well, I'm the late stage one. And then she had a recurrence and passed away. And this was over, you know, like a year and a half. And by the end, she was like growing her own food and stuff. And I had struggled so much with, like, honestly, orthorexia, with like just being like, everything I eat is going to give me cancer. It has to be my fault I got cancer. So I need to be so careful about every food. And everyone's telling me this food is causing, like, I was a vegetarian for so long, and someone told me I ate too much red meat. And I said, that must have been it. And I'm like, where's the logic, Annie? Like, get it together. You're just so guilty that you think it must be your fault. And when she passed away, I felt like such shame, and I'd started to do some advocacy, but then I felt like, well, I can't do advocacy because I haven't had chemo. So I haven't struggled as much as somebody else has. But it's like, but I'm also stage four. So like, why am I, like, all these things that I was, these mental gymnastics I was doing in my head were torture. And what that eventually led to, which is when I was getting help, was I felt like I was in crisis mode all the time. Like, I woke up in a panic. I would silently cry to myself in private. I couldn't see straight a lot of the time because I was in such a state of just fight or flight that I just was, it felt like I was buzzing almost all the time. Like, it felt like white noise. Like, I existed in like a, just a white noise bubble all the time, and that nothing was real. Like, it was just so out of body that it almost, it led me down a road of having suicidal thoughts, honestly. And it was such a weird thing because there was nothing more I wanted than to be alive, than to live through the disease and to live a long life. And yet the burden of that mental toll and the burden of the guilt and shame will literally kill you. And it's so sad how many people just swallow that down because they want to appear strong. And I think that's why, you know, I kind of made myself get involved in community because I knew I needed help and I didn't know how to get it. And I'd done individual therapy, but I still felt alone in my life in a lot of ways, because like, no matter how much love you have, if you don't feel understood, it's horrible. And so many cancer patients, you're immediately like an alien. Everyone looks at you like a Mother Teresa type figure out of nowhere, and you're like, I'm still fun, like, what do you mean? Yes. Why am I wise all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Like, I just got like, I don't get this, like,
yeah.
Everyone's crying, they look at you with like such pity, and it's so weird. And then I remember sitting in my first support group that was like a group of young survivors, and just everyone was saying out loud these things that I thought were like deep, shameful thoughts that I could never say out loud. And they weren't. and hearing them from somebody else, I was like, wow, it's actually okay. Like, the way I'm feeling is okay. All of it is valid. And if you don't express it, it will bubble up and just come out whenever you don't want it to. Like, and I think that's where I've learned, like, I used to think that all those were bad feelings. And while they don't feel good to feel, they're not bad feelings. Like, they just are what they are. And so for me, I think, like, community and therapy are by far the best things. And when doing those, you develop tools that you can help yourself through anything. You know, I've developed tools through therapy that I use for many things in my life, like even just going through a breakup with the person that I was with the whole time that I had cancer was very confronting. On like, oh, there's a deep part of me that is not healed that still believes I'm unlovable because of my disease, and that this was the only person who would love me because he met me before I got sick. And I'm like, damn, I thought I dealt with that. And there it is, yes, coming right up. But I knew how to face it, and I knew I had to voice it, and I knew I had to go to my community. And what do you know? A bunch of people have been divorced and broken up with and cheated on and face those feelings.
Yeah, life keeps
going. Yeah, and none of us are perfect, but it's so, I cannot tell you how extraordinary it is to be, like, I was just in a room with 75 other women who were diagnosed metastatic under 40, and we're funny as hell. Everyone is beautiful. They have these extraordinary lives, and we just all ended up with the same disease. And maybe we wouldn't have ever met if it wasn't for that. But these women change my life every day. And the conversations we have with each other, these group chats we have, these WhatsApp, like I'm in so many chats. And even just when I started posting on social media, like the messages that I get of people, the only reason I posted anything was because there was nobody there when I got diagnosed. I was alone. There was Instagram, but there wasn't TikTok and stuff.
Right.
Nobody's making videos. And now, like, there's, you can go, you know, hear these statistics of you're going to die in 2 to 5 years, this and that. And then you can go online and see a bunch of women that are me, 10 years plus. My friend Heather has been living for 26 years plus and has 2 kids that she adopted. Like, there is life, there is hope, there is reality. But just because a statistic says one thing doesn't mean that that's going to be your life. So I feel like, for me, community has given me power, and it's also made me a better advocate because everything I do is for them. Mm-hmm. So I don't, like, I used to get so nervous when I would do stand-up and things like that. But when I'm here, I'm using a lot of these same skills when I'm doing advocacy of, like, writing and making jokes that make things more digestible and all of that. But I'm doing it for my friends. For, these are my sisters, these people, and I've lost so many of them. Like, the handbag I have today was made in honor of my friend Lizzie, who passed away last year.
Wow.
And it's just, I literally carry these people with me everywhere I go. Because all I would want if I were to pass away is I would never want any of my friends to feel bad that they were still here. Not even for a second.
Yeah.
Never. I would want them to think about me with such joy and love. And if I'm not living that, then how would I expect to be remembered like that?
That's so powerful. Just to hear you put into words some of those inner struggles is it's really just so empowering, I hope, for other patients to hear that and not feel so alone. There's patients that I see in clinic that, you know, I feel like you're kind of hitting on at the beginning. Things are moving fast and you're getting tests and you're starting treatment. And then hopefully, you know, you get into kind of, you know, an autopilot mode where things kind of quiet down a little bit. And, you know, I'll see patients and sometimes I feel like I can just see it on their face that, like, there's so much going on behind there and just
but
trying
I'm fine.
To ask. Yes,
but
exactly.
I'm fine. Yeah.
That's totally it. And just asking, you know, how are you? How is mental health? And yes, fine. Do you have any advice for providers on how, you know, anything that we can do to help encourage patients to maybe get involved with support groups or referrals to mental health? Like, was there a pivotal moment that really shifted things for you, or did it take friends, family, you know, what kind of advice would you have about that?
Yeah, my oncologist, like that third oncologist, and definitely like some of the nurses there had mentioned that, you know, make sure you take care of your mental health a little bit. And my parents also are very like, they play music, they do all these things that are very like creative outlet. But it is really hard. And I think it takes a lot of bravery from the patient side to put yourself out there like that. And especially when you're using all of your energy to just seem okay for the people that you love. And especially like for parents and stuff, like for your kids, like you don't think you have that capacity to like let it out Because once you let it out, what are you going to do? Like, how are you going to get it back in? But what I always try to think of it as is, like, you know, you can't hold anything in forever. Everything will bubble up and then it'll happen at the wrong time, like I said. But I think for doctors, you have to just keep bringing it up and offer that resource. Like, so many hospitals do have these support groups, and a lot of them are virtual now, so you don't have to leave your house. Although I do think the in-person stuff is good. But like, these summits and stuff, I know, are very intimidating for people. They were intimidating for me to go to as well, especially being metastatic. Like, to be in a group of mostly early stage survivors can be even more isolating. And whether they want to or not, they also look at you with fear and this stuff. So it does take an incredible amount of bravery to ask for help. And I think all it takes is meeting one person. And something that my oncologist said that I found extremely useful is he had me talk to other patients of his. Like, when I was getting the surgery on my liver, there was a 70-year-old woman in the other room who had gotten it, you know, 5 years prior. And he said, hey, do you want to come in and have a conversation with her? She's open to it. And I said, absolutely. He's connected me with other patients to talk to, whether it's just phone call or what. And there are organizations like Immerman Angels that will match you one-on-one for free with somebody with a similar, like, if you want to just talk to somebody young, you can. If you want somebody specifically for your disease, like, there are ways to do that. But I think for providers especially, there's so many organizations, it's hard to keep track of. Connect your patients. If you have two young women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, who maybe have a similar subtype or something, ask them if they want to connect.
Yeah.
I don't know what HIPAA laws or anything, but I feel like you guys can do that, you know?
And I think we're seeing more of that. We're seeing a lot of initiatives in trying to get support groups going, you know, within different centers. So I'm so glad to hear that that was helpful.
The group can be intimidating. Yes. It can be intimidating to walk into a room with a bunch of people and feel like, I don't belong here. Or, I don't have anything to say. And just talking to one person cracks the door open.
Yeah.
And that's all it takes. To be brave, all you need is a little push.
That's so good to hear.
And that's a little push.
Because I feel like, and just to hear, like, just keep asking. Because sometimes you're like, oh, am I being a broken record by, like, asking them all the time about mental health? But you never know, like, when that moment will finally come where someone can really use that. I want to shift for just a second to physical side effects.
Yes.
Because you've been on this treatment for 10 years now, correct? That's incredible. Now in your day-to-day, what are the biggest side effects that you notice in any lifestyle things that seem to help? Because I know you mentioned, like, walking.
I love walking. I'll talk about walking all day.
Yeah. No, tell us more. What helps
you? I love
you?
A walk. I would say definitely, like, mental stuff always exists, for sure, like we said. Yes. But physically, joint pain, which, again, walking, stretching, doesn't have to be straight. If you don't like yoga, it's fine. I love yoga, personally.
Yeah.
Walking and stretching are great things to do daily. I love gardening. Like, the unfortunate truth is that what helps with joint pain is exercise, and also helps with your mental health. And I know, annoying.
Yes.
I know, but it does help. Just get up and walk for, like, 10 minutes. You'll feel a little better. But I think, too, like, I mean, the menopause physical stuff is definitely one of the hardest things to navigate. But I think there's a lot of good research coming out about, like, topical estrogen and, you know, even, like, hyaluronic acid, like, the inserts and things like that. That, you know, it took me a while to come down to topical estrogen because I was like, I know you're telling me it's safe and I trust you, but I don't know.
It just feels wrong.
And now I've read enough research and I'm like, okay, I guess I'll finally. Maybe I'll finally do it.
And did you notice a big difference?
I haven't done it yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to, but I've heard really good things. So I know. Again, it sounded so scary. It's like, estrogen is the enemy.
That's what my patients always say. They're like, you've been telling me all this time. My cancer feeds off estrogen and now what?
But I think, like, physically too, like, so PTSD is physical. This is the thing. It is mental, but it is a panic disorder. And I think that's something a lot of people don't understand. Like, I have chronic fatigue. I have all these things, whatever. The PTSD is the hardest thing to deal with. And to me, that is a physical thing because that is a physical way that my body reacts to life. And it is not always reasonable. It's not always like something triggering happened and now I'm triggered and I feel crazy. Like, it's not always that. It can be something small spikes your adrenaline, like a little road rage, a little, like, I used to walk a lot of dogs and I would walk reactive dogs. And then someone has their dog off leash and they're like, he's friendly. And I'm like, this dog is traumatized. Like, then your adrenaline spikes and your body says, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And that's crazy. Like, the panic attacks that happen, like, especially like right outside of treatment, like when, which given I'm always in treatment because I'm metastatic, but when it was like, you're no evidence of disease, you're in remission, like I was getting all these great words that I didn't think I was allowed to use. It's like, oh no, survivorship is hard. Survivorship is a whole different battle. And instead of, I wish instead of us feeling like it was a phase, like cancer is a phase, we were more prepared for that a little bit. Because I always thought PTSD was like, you hear a bomb and you think you're in the war. And like, yes, for some people who've been in war, it is like that. But I've worked with trauma specialists who literally work with veterans and cancer patients. Because there is an overlap, because PTSD is a panic disorder that you do not have control over, but that you can combat from a physical level. Like, I have anxiety medicine. Like, I'll take a lorazepam if I know I'm stressed out or if I feel that stress coming. Like, it's always something that I talk about with my team is, like, how can we physically help my nervous system? Yes. Because we know how horrible stress is. Stress is honestly worse than, like, smoking cigarettes. Like, it's, like, crazy the data that I've seen about stress. And so it's impossible to not be stressed in this day and age, even without cancer, but especially as a young person with cancer, because it does affect your career, your love life, your friendships. Like, all of these things happen that have nothing to do with cancer directly, but have to do with the fact that you got cancer, like, and that you have no control over. But you do have control over how you react to things. So I would say, like, when it comes to physical stuff, like, recognize that mental and physical are tied.
Couldn't
agree more. Vice versa.
Oh, yes.
So there is medication that can help you. And like for me, I personally am scared to like be on an everyday anxiety medication because I know how access to medication works in this country. And if you can't get access to something you take every day, you will have withdrawals. And I know how my body feels like, even like I don't drink very often, but I will, if I'm going to a wedding, I'm going to drink at my friend's wedding. Life's too short. Yeah. If I have a hangover, it's a mess.
Yes.
I'm like, it must be a tumor. Must be this. What have I done to myself? I've given myself cancer again in my liver. Oh my God, I'm such an idiot. And like now, like I, again,
it's always
also
there.
Learning, I think, is one of the most important things. Learning is great. The more that we can understand, which is hard, science is hard for us normies, you know, but the more that I understand, the more power I feel like I have. And so I think like community helps you with knowledge. Advocacy helps you with knowledge. And knowledge is power, because when you understand why something is happening, or you understand why this medication works, or you understand why your disease works the way it does, you have power over a lot, or you understand why side effects happen. Even like I just recently learned what a hot flash is. Recently learned what a hot flash is. And I always thought like, oh, you're just hot. And then you feel, then I get anxious because I have anxiety. It's like, no, your body, there's like a thermostat in your brain that is controlled by estrogen. So literally your body is telling you that you're on fire, essentially. Not like on fire, on fire. But like, that's your brain. It's a real thing. You're not crazy. Your brain is just being crazy for a minute because its thermostat is out of batteries,
right,
you know?
Right.
But like learning those things to me is very validating and makes me feel like, okay, now that I have the education, I can put actual physical things into play to help alleviate like how this affects my life. The only thing I feel like I have trouble with finding a solution for is memory loss, because it's a hard thing to quantify and to research is what I've learned.
Yes.
So we just don't have a lot of help for that, but it is definitely a thing. Like, and I didn't get IV chemo, and I always thought like, oh, chemo brain is related to chemo. Well, menopause brain is a thing as well.
Absolutely.
Trauma brain is a thing as well. Like, there's a lot of stuff from cancer treatment that affects your memory, and I really wish that we had more solutions for that. Because, like, I could drink a bunch of mushrooms all day or whatever, and I don't think that's going to fix my memory.
Right, right.
Sorry to the mushroom coffee companies. I don't think you're fixing my brain.
Yes.
So sorry.
Well, you just gave me the perfect segue to kind of a wrap-up question that I want to put you on the spot. What do you think, or I should say, What would you love to see us learn more about in the breast cancer survivorship world right now? Like, what do you think is really missing, and what do you hope to see next in the future?
Yeah, what I think is missing, I'm honestly, personally, very tired of hearing why it's my fault, because it's not my fault. And I feel like, you know, last year, the whole conversation was around alcohol and breast cancer. Okay, well, I had stopped drinking for a long time. And before that, it was red meat. Okay, well, I didn't eat red meat. It's like there's all these things that you feel like, oh, there must be a correlation here. But even like with the alcohol and breast cancer, now they're being like, well, it's also kind of inconclusive. Like, yeah, obviously alcohol is bad for you. Wow, what do you know? Cigarettes are bad for you. Wow, what do you know?
Yeah.
But like, it feels like they keep tying things to diet. Like, everyone wants to tie everything to diet.
Yes.
To your risk assessment, this and that. And that scares me because that isn't fixing any of the problems that I have personally seen in any of this. So, like, I've seen people starve themselves out of guilt. I've done it myself. Wow. I see a lot of people develop eating disorders with getting a cancer diagnosis because you think it's your fault. You think it's the food. And so the more studies we have saying, like, well, if you ate more plant-based, if you ate more like this, I've seen people with every type of diet, marathon runners,
like,
literally world-class athletes, like one of Taylor Swift's dancers on the Eras Tour got a breast cancer diagnosis. And like, it just can happen to anyone at any time. So I would just love to see more education around that, and especially around family history, because I had the misconception, which is why I wasn't doing self-exams, that my family history played a large role in my risk. So you look at the Tyler, was how you say the last, the Tyler test. Actually, it's Tyre. That's what I keep saying, Tyler.
Yes.
There's no Tyler.
Tyler Cusick. Yes. Yes.
So Olivia Munn started this big conversation about that, which I think, yes, if you have a family history, you need to have that education. I took that test. Guess what my risk factor was? 0.0000001%. That doesn't invalidate that I got breast cancer. It doesn't mean I was immune to it. And I think the misconceptions I had around I eat healthy, I live a healthy lifestyle, I'm young, I don't have a family history, gave me this false sense of security. And the same thing with these full body MRIs. We think if you get this full body MRI, well, that covers, well, that doesn't cover your breast screening. You know, and also this myth of like only women in their 40s get breast cancer. Well, tell it to my friend who got diagnosed when she was 18.
Yeah.
Tell that to me who got diagnosed when I was 26. So I think there is a huge lack of education when it comes to why people get cancer, because it's much easier to say, well, they must have done something wrong and I must be doing something right, than it is to say it just happens. Yeah. There's no comfort in saying it just happens. There's no actionable thing you can do. So what I like, and this is interesting to me because I hate AI in one term, as an artist, as somebody who does music, who loves, you know, the theater, who loves movies, hate it. Get it out of the arts. When it comes to medicine, it has been a powerful tool for my community to not only better understand things about our illnesses that we have not understood before, or things about clinical trials or resources that we did not understand before, which, given, like, please fact check everything. But I am very encouraged by these AI risk assessment models that take into things, take more into account like dense breasts, individual risk, because we have been touting family history as the reason people get cancer, especially breast cancer, for too long, when it is less than 10% of all breast cancer cases have a family history at all.
Yeah.
And people don't know that. They don't know. And even when I tell people I have metastatic breast cancer, and then later I've mentioned the word stage four, they go, no, that's not the same thing. I'm like, oh, honey.
Yes.
I didn't know you could only die of stage four cancer. I didn't know breast cancer could be in my liver. I thought I had a liver tumor, which I did, but it was a breast cancer tumor in my liver. So I think for the future of breast cancer is about prediction and not prevention.
Yeah.
Because I wish we could prevent it. I wish it was as simple as diet. I wish it was as simple as just cutting out alcohol. I wish it was simple. And it's not. And that has been the hardest thing for me to learn and accept. As somebody who got it, it was much easier to blame myself than it was to look at the reality. Mm-hmm. But the reality is freeing, because the truth is the truth.
Yeah.
And you cannot change the truth. Just something my ex didn't understand. But
I love it.
It's okay. But I just, I think that, you know, this is really some newer stuff that we've seen where they've rolled back these AI risk assessments to 35. Mm-hmm. We need to be doing younger. Because what are we doing for the younger population? This is what I don't understand. We have all these tools. We have all this knowledge. And yet we still tell people they're too young for cancer. That should be illegal. Mm-hmm. It should be illegal. Because you're going to say St. Jude's doesn't exist?
Right.
A whole hospital full of children that we've all cried at a commercial for around Christmas? Mm-hmm. Those are children. Is it their fault that they're sick? Go tell them that to their face. Go tell their parents that to their face. Because you're brave enough to say it to my face. But you can't say it to theirs, can you?
Yeah.
That's cancer. Cancer doesn't care what your political affiliation is. It doesn't care how happy you are. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care what you have going on in your life. It doesn't care if you're a child. It can happen. And for breast cancer, there are things that now we can look at, like dense breasts, that were never a conversation when I was diagnosed in 2015. I was always told I had dense breasts and that it was nothing to worry about.
Yeah, I think we're about to see a huge shift in a lot of these things with these AI tools coming out that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And dropping some huge pearls for us to
I think too, like education too is the last thing I want to touch on is like, I would love to see high schools when it comes to sex education, which I know is a controversial topic, I guess. But like, I would love to go into there and teach people about self-exams, about just knowing your body. I think people also get scared of the word self-exam. Like, it has to be some big professional thing. I always tell people, I'm like, just touch around when you get in the shower, like, just touch around a little bit.
Yeah.
You'll probably feel if there's something there. Mm-hmm. Pay attention. Look at your body. If you don't have, like, if you have a romantic partner, like, tell them, like, hey, have you ever noticed anything weird? Like, sorry if it ruins the mood, but it could save my life.
Right.
But there just is no education. And I think the false concept that we have some power over whether or not we get cancer is what's hurting people the most. And if more people could just accept the risk is that any it can happen to any of us, and you should know, yes, your family history and stuff, but you should also know that there are things that can happen without a family history, that there are different ways that you can check for it. Mm-hmm. But if the regulations and stuff do not change, then we will keep having more situations like mine where it takes 9 months to get a diagnosis when it could have happened 9 months earlier. And maybe I would have been at earlier stage. And early stage breast cancer is curable.
Right. Yeah.
The recurrence rate is still high and that sucks. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we shy away from metastatic research. We shy away from saying the word metastatic. Mm-hmm. It's a dirty word.
Yeah.
It's a dirty to talk about death. Like, no, we are all going to die. We all have limited time and we could all get cancer. And I'm so sorry that that is not comforting. And I'm so sorry that like I have to be an example of everyone's worst nightmare. But the reason I am always talking and yelling about it, not yelling, I talk with a reasonable voice. Sometimes I'm yelling. Is because I just want people to know. And I can't tell you how many messages I get from people, you know, I went to high school with or someone, I mean, now that I have a social media following, people I've never met. They're like, I just want you to know that I felt a lump and I went and I got it looked at and I had to push for an ultrasound and thankfully it was benign or like I got diagnosed earlier.
Yeah.
All I want to see is earlier diagnoses. Mm-hmm. I do not want anyone else to have to have metastatic breast cancer ever again.
Yeah.
I just don't want to see it. I want it to be curable. I want us to have a better quality of life. But I also know that there is no way we can stop breast cancer deaths without education about metastatic breast cancer and without funding for metastatic breast cancer research. So I will never shut up is my plan.
I am so appreciative of your advocacy and everything you're doing. It's so powerful and cannot thank you enough for sharing some time with us and being so open. Thank you so much, Annie.
Before
we go, will you tell everybody where they can find you on social media?
You can find me in a little hole yelling about my precious ring. No, I'm on Instagram, TikTok. It's at the Annie Bond. Because there actually is another woman named Annie Bond. She does like crystal healing.
Oh, wow.
And that's not me.
This is the Annie Bond.
T-H-E, I am the Annie Bond.
Yeah.
And if you like just seeing somebody live their best life they can with metastatic disease and have a lot of fun adventures and I'm just annoyingly grateful to be alive and crying about every little cute dog they see, come on over to my page.
I love it. Well, we love you, Annie. Thank you so much again.
Thank you. And thank you to all the doctors and nurses out there. I love you guys. You're doing great work. And researchers, you're doing great. All of you are doing great.